Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Blizzard Comedy Chat. Today we are going to be speaking to the absolutely fantastic Eleanor Morton. Really grateful, Eleanor, for having talked to me and being on the show. This was a really fun conversation. If you've not heard of Eleanor Morton before, absolutely look her up. I highly recommend it. She is absolutely fantastic. You can find two of her shows on Next Up Comedy if you're a subscriber to that, or if you look up our latest episode of Blizzard Comedy Archives, we've got a few clips of her there, and I'm sure she has more clips available on YouTube as well. I'm really excited to hear this conversation, so I'm not going to bore you with lots of preamble like I usually do. So without further ado, let's talk to Eleanor Morton. When did you first discover stand-up? Not necessarily as a performer yourself, just as something that you enjoyed watching.
I don't have like a specific memory, but I think I remember. I think the first thing I saw. Obviously, I knew the. I grew up in Edinburgh, so I knew the Fringe was there.
Yeah.
But there was not really. It was nothing for children, really. like 20 years ago. Oh my God, I'm so old. We didn't go to the Fringe because it was expensive and there wasn't really a lot of stuff for us. I think it was after I started watching Black Books.
Love it.
I saw that Bill Bailey had a stand-up show on Channel 4, and I managed to record some of it.
Oh, fantastic. Just out of interest, yeah, do you remember which one it was? Because I'm quite a big Bill Bailey fan.
It was Part Troll.
Oh, that's, yeah, classic one, that.
Yeah, yeah, so I just really liked him. I really liked his... I think he's very warm and likable.
He is,
and
yeah.
Very funny and very creative, and I really liked that kind of thing. And then I think I saw some Ross Noble after that.
Okay.
So, but I didn't have like a huge. It wasn't that I watched a lot of it. I watched a lot of comedy, but I didn't watch a lot of stand up. It was more that I wanted to perform it, sort of.
Okay.
Which is, I don't know if that's like good or bad, because I feel like a lot of people go into it being very like, well, you know, they start later and then they've spent years watching live comedy, which I didn't do because I wasn't old enough. So.
Yeah, that's fair. So, would you say that your interest in kind of like narrative comedy sort of predates your interest in stand up?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think I liked. The earliest stuff I saw that was like what you might call grown-up comedy was my dad had a bunch of old Radio 4 tapes, like The Goons and The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah.
So I really liked that really stupid but clever stuff, that kind of interweaving of clever and nonsensical at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then when I was 16 or 17... We saw some comics at the Fringe. That was the first time I must have gone to any live comedy, and that was, we went to see Ed Byrne and, who was the other one? Oh, Russell Howard.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so pretty like standard.
What kind of era are you talking about? Is this when, like, before they were like sort of household names kind of thing?
I think Ed was pretty famous.
Yeah.
And I think Russell Howard must have been just on the peak of, not the peak, what's the word, of something big, because it was in the Assembly on George Street, so it was, you know, there were big rooms.
Yeah.
And that was great, and since I was 14, I sort of decided I'd like to do it, and then it was just like a kind of, after that, kind of discovering more and more bits and pieces and clips and things, because there wasn't really like, YouTube was still in its infancy. so there wasn't like that massive, lot of clips and things that you can, and you know, you couldn't find stuff online the same way you can now.
Yeah, of course.
That was the beginning.
Sure.
And Stuart Lee. I remember Stuart Lee from quite early on, but I don't know when I first saw him. I honestly.
That's a really interesting one. I wouldn't strike him as comedian you'd get, because I know certainly the first time I saw his stuff, like I definitely that I feel like that's. A comedian for people who have watched a lot of comedy. I wouldn't have put that as...
I don't know. I think he's a bit of a comedian's comedian as well, though. He's very, like... I think if you are a comedian, you instantly gravitate towards his sort of stuff. But I honestly can't remember when I first started to watch him. Way back in the mists of time, I guess.
Yeah, of course. So in terms of like your own kind of interest in performance, you mentioned earlier you were kind of sort of more interested in the performing side of comedy. Did you ever intend to like try stand up, or was it were you more interested in being more of like a kind of actor, or what kind of?
Originally I was already interested in acting when I was young. I wanted to do acting, and that was sort of, I went to youth theatre and that kind of thing, and I sort of had that thing that quite a lot of performers, I think, have, where they're quite awkward and shy and not necessarily very happy in real life, but they really want to perform, even if it makes them feel sick.
Yeah, I feel that.
And then I think it was just a thing I found, you know, that sort of classic thing of if you make people laugh on purpose, they won't laugh at you quite so much without your permission, basically. So when I was 14, I think I started writing some really terrible hacky material. And
was this kind of like stand-up stuff or more kind of like sketch? Or
I think I'd already written some terrible sketches, but I was on a school trip, and I said something rude in front of a teacher, and, you know, like a light-hearted conversation, but he said he made me do a sort of public apology in front of everyone.
Oh,
and
no.
I think I really enjoyed, you know, I felt that sort of, oh, this is good, you know, just getting up and making people laugh, and everyone was talking about it, and I was like, yeah, I really like this kind of the creativity there. And I think as much as I wanted to act, I think the older I got, the more I realised that acting is great, but it's not actually very creative. You're quite limited because you're doing what other people want you to do, and
yeah, that makes sense.
You don't actually get a lot of choices, you know. So
no, see, like, you kind of think you do. I mean, and theoretically, there's a lot you can do with acting, even with like a pre-written script. You can put your own flair on it, but ultimately, in any kind of professional environment, there will be a director who kind of facilitates all that. And yeah, and depending on, I think most cases, you probably don't really get a lot of say over how you play a character.
Yeah, yeah. I think as also just like as a woman, you feel like there's that thing of you don't really like being controlled, maybe. So I like acting, but I prefer stand up just because, you know, it's a bit more improv and it's a bit more in the moment and all that stuff. And then I just kind of had that in the back of my head. I really wanted to start doing it when I was sort of old enough, and I went to there was a feminist website I followed, and they were having a feminist class on how to do stand-up comedy in Edinburgh.
Right.
And it
cool.
was like Shan Bevan, who's a great Edinburgh-based comic, and she was just really nice and encouraging, and it was obviously a nice environment. It wasn't like me and 10 like 19-year-old boys, which is
I imagine, you know, most other courses,
exactly. So I did that, and then I eventually signed up to do a gig at the Grass in the Beehive at the Grass Market.
Okay.
If you know that.
I'm not too familiar. No, it's been a long time since I've been to Edinburgh, so I don't know the venues that well.
It feels like it's been a long time since any of us have done anything now. So I did a gig there when I was 18, and I was really nervous, but I was sort of like, I don't know, I just thought, this is, you know, this is something I have to do because I'll kick myself if I never have a go. And and then I just sort of kept going, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to your first gig, so did you say you were doing kind of like a course in sort of how to write and perform and that kind of thing? Like what did that involve?
It wasn't even that. It was sort of just like a one day workshop thing,
okay.
Sort of like an hour maybe, where we all just sort of like a very, very basic intro to the idea of it, and that just sort of gave me the nudge. I think also Shan maybe had a sheet of gigs in Edinburgh, and so she gave me that, and that helped, like, you know, actually find out where the actual gigs were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that there were many.
No. It's weird though. Like, I mean, I don't know a great deal about the circuit in Edinburgh. But I remember when I was researching it, I was surprised at just how little there is, because you assume because the fringe is there that there's loads, but outside the fringe, it doesn't appear to be that many.
No, it's funny. It's like it's just not really big enough. I mean, I think in the way that like Scotland, I would say, has a comedy scene on the same sort of. Probably smaller actually than London, you know what I mean? It's like instead of a city thing, it's a country thing.
The whole
it's just
of
not really,
right, yeah.
Yeah, enough people. But at that point there was a couple of gigs, and that one was run by, I can't remember what they were called now, but I think it was just called something like Beehive Comedy. But I think if I hadn't got that sheet of information, I wouldn't have known exactly, you know, how to start or anything. So where was your first one? Were you in Manchester when you did your?
No, I was in London where my first one. So what it was is I'd met a bunch of people who were kind of doing stand up as part of their, like, they had like a little sick form comedy club thing, which is partly why I went to that sick form, actually, because I thought that'd be a nice way to get introduced to it. So I'd kind of been toying with the idea for a while. I'd vaguely written some stuff, And my mates were going to an open mic night in Greenwich. It wasn't a comedy open mic night, it was just like a kind of mixed bag kind of thing. I went along with fully with the intention of just kind of watching and kind of sort of like getting a feel for the vibe without actually performing. But by the time I got there, my mates basically signed me up on the door, so I had to do it. And considering that, I wasn't completely unprepared. I had stuff ready just in case that I felt the urge to go up. But I think without that kind of nudge, it would have been a lot longer before I actually got around to doing it myself. Because the nerves, the nerves of it in theory were a lot worse than in practice, I found.
I think, and also the longer I do it, the more I find it hard to believe that people find public speaking scary.
Yeah. Because,
you know, once you do it X amount of times, it's really just this thing you do, and then, you know, nobody's really, half the time no one's paying attention, and half the time no one will remember, so everything people are scared of is, you know, not actually going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, but I also do, like, I still get the it's always the fairy nerves, it's always sort of building up to it. Like, by the time I'm actually at the venue, I'm normally fine.
What I find is that the amount of time I'm nervous for is gets smaller and smaller the more I gig. So,
yeah.
You know, the first ever gig, it was like a month of feeling sick. And then nowadays, well, in the pre-times, it was sort of like, maybe just before I went on. And I'd still do get nervous, obviously, like doing certain gigs and doing new gigs and trying certain things or whatever. But generally, you know, I'm amazed how much less anxious I am about it. I have anxiety and it doesn't faze me nearly as much as other much more normal activities do. So
it is interesting.
I'm sure a lot of comics find that.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, this could be completely bullshit, but I feel like you have a lot more control over, like, stand-up is one of those few environments, like, because I'm a very socially anxious person. I'm not very good at holding conversations in most contexts, but stand-up is a very controlled environment where, like, there's a kind of level of social etiquette that people kind of have to listen to you. So I don't know, particularly with doing my own gig, because I know it's kind of like my audience anyway, and I find that a lot more comfortable than speaking in any any other situation. And even if it's a bad gig where I know I'm not going to do well, I don't know, there's something about it that it just feels easier to go into that, like, and maybe knowing it's going to be bad helps. I don't know.
I don't know what it is. It's sort of like, maybe it's because, you know, if you've done the material X amount of times, I mean, obviously, there's always that thing, if it's a bad gig, where you go, well, I'm the worst in the world and I should definitely not do this.
Yeah.
But then also you are like, I know these jokes have worked before.
Yeah.
So this is just, you know, it's just night and then I'll do another gig and that will be better and I'll forget this one. So
yeah,
it's a very, it's very, like, very quick up and downs, I think.
Definitely. So just go back to your first gig. How did you think it went at the time? And looking back on it, how do you feel about it?
Well, it went really well.
Yeah.
And it did, but the reason was I had all my friends decided to come along. Aww. It was really nice of them, actually.
That is nice.
Yeah. And I was at college at the time. It was doing an acting course at Edinburgh College, and then all my friends from that came, and all my friends from school came. And my friend Stuart's parents came. In fact, was it two sets of parents? Anyway, so the whole audience was basically people I knew and people who were rooting for me, and that made it really nice. I wonder how I would have felt if it might have been completely different and people might not have enjoyed it, and would that have made me decide not to do it again? I don't know, but it's weird because I started doing musical comedy.
Okay.
Because I've always enjoyed writing songs, and I found it was, I was still a bit too nervous to just go up and talk. You know, I needed that kind of shield of of something. Music.
What did you play?
I played ukulele because it is cheap and very easy to learn.
Yeah. Also very easy to transport, I imagine, as well.
Yes. Especially, the cheaper they are, the lighter they are as well.
Yeah.
But I am a grade 7 at piano. I want people to know that because, you know, I can't actually play stuff. But yeah, and I just wrote a silly song and I thought, oh, that'll do because, you know, it's the thing about music is people tend to be impressed that you've done it at all, even if it's not funny. So it gives you a lot of leeway.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
if the jokes aren't there. and it was really nice having people there, but at the same time, I've never been the sort of person... Like, so Tom Burgess, my boyfriend, he is always, you know, delighted if his friends turn up or his parents turn up. And I've never been like that. I actually prefer a room full of strangers because I feel like, in a way, you can just relax a bit more because you're not playing with people's preconceived notions of who you are, if that makes sense. You know, like...
Yeah, I think so.
You go up there and talk about, like, certain stuff people might think, that's not what she's like in real life, and they don't... I don't know. I mean, that's probably just me in my head, but I find it much better when I'm not thinking about, like, oh, I hope my mum doesn't take offence to this material, or I hope my friends know that I don't really think about this. You know what I mean? So I don't know if you find that, but I'd much rather do it to people I don't know and will never meet again.
I don't know if I entirely feel that, but I do get the, like, the nice thing about doing a gig in front of strangers is... If you want to, you can, like, never think about that again as soon as you're done.
Yeah.
Whereas, if you've got mates or anyone coming to see you, like, this whole thing, like, especially if it doesn't go well, there's always that kind of elephant in the room for, like, days afterwards where, like, it's not really fun for anyone. Like, now I'm kind of, like...
No.
It's quite rare that I won't know anyone in my... I mean, I don't gig that often, to be honest, so... Like, the gigs I normally do are my own gigs, in which case there's a lot of regulars who are my friends anyway. Or, if it's in Manchester, chances are, so I don't know, we'll be coming along. So, I definitely quite like it now. It is one of the things I do like about travelling to do gigs, which I didn't do nearly enough. But, like, I really like being in Leeds for that reason, because it was just kind of like a whole new crowd. And, it is...
Demographic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, and it's interesting.
Yeah, you feel like Jasmine on that magic carpet when you go to Leeds.
Yeah, absolutely, and I don't know, it feels a bit more legitimate, I suppose, as well, if I don't feel that anyone there is socially obliged to find me funny.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. I always feel a bit like I'm cheating when my friends come, because I'm like, well, you'll be nice about it anyway.
Yeah.
Although I have spoken to lots of comics whose friends all seem like, you know, if they're related, much more men than women, but their relationships are always, their friends come along and try and make them have a horrible time. I'm glad I'm not in that kind of masculine sphere of...
Oh, same, yeah.
Sort of your friendship being where you slang each other a full time.
Yeah.
So mine have always been lovely and supportive. And then, of course, the issue with being from Edinburgh is every time I do the Fringe, everyone from my entire life can come and see, and sometimes that's fun, and I see people I haven't seen in ages, and I'm like, oh, it's so nice, and sometimes it's like, oh, God, please don't turn up, you know? I feel more exposed in a way than a lot of people, but...
I can imagine, particularly with Edinburgh as well, if you're doing your kind of, like, hour shows, because that's... a lot more kind of personal, you're talking, maybe going a lot deeper than you would in just a club set, so it's not just a show of you being funny for an hour. I mean, it is, but there's more to it than that, and
there's stuff there that people know happened or didn't happen or whatever.
Yeah, and that's the thing on the subject of kind of like friends and family going to see my gigs. The first time I ever explicitly mentioned in front of my parents that I was bisexual was because I did a bit about it when they came to see me. Like, I'd never kind of hidden it from them, and like, it's like one of the oldest routines that I still do. Like I never kind of hid it from them, but like there was a thing as I was doing, it was just like, I'd never actually had this conversation with them, so I don't. they didn't bring it up, but they didn't treat me any differently. So
It's sort of like when you're, you know, if you have a birthday party and you invite all your different groups of friends, and you're like, you're always a slightly different person depending on who you're hanging out with.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh no, they'll all see the real me.
Yeah.
And then they'll be like, what's happening, you know? So, I feel like my stage persona as well is sort of, in a way, more myself, but also it's not.
I definitely feel that.
Yeah, and so it's like, what do people think when they see, when they're like friends of mine, how do they deal with that? But I mean, they're always very nice about it.
Yeah.
So
I think the
yeah, I can't
I think the really the interesting thing as well is because I started in London, and I think this.
Are you from London?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm from London originally. Walthamstow, Yeah, so from London originally, and then I moved up to Salford for uni, and I've just been around this area since then. But the thing with London is obviously, particularly the open mic stuff, it's all bringer gigs. And I know a lot of people have strong opinions about bringer gigs. I don't particularly hate them as open mic formats. I think it's because the thing I like about London is it's very easy to get stage time and practice at the beginning. Yeah. So I'm really glad I started out there. I feel like I'm glad I moved to Manchester because it was easier to kind of progress a bit from the open mic scene. But yeah. I think London's a really good place to start. But yeah, the fact that I kind of had to bring people I knew along to my gigs anyway. Sort of, I guess I just had to get used to that, and I think that might be a bit of the kind of man culture of going along to gigs and trying to make them have a horrible time just because they've probably done it. They've probably had to go along him more times than they would have liked.
Yeah, it's I do feel like I exhaust a lot of will with my friends because I don't like them coming to gigs, but I do like them coming to previews because previews is when I need audience.
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey guys, come to this gig. It's not as good as will be when it's finished, but I don't really care because you're not a proper audience. You're people I know, so come along and fill the seats, please. That's it. Like gigging in London, like my first gigs in London were like such exciting things, even though they were like, you know, very obscure open mic things.
But which ones were they?
The Rose and Crown in Kentish Town. It was the Grand. It was TNT.
TNT. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I did that one a lot when I started out. Yeah.
Yeah. I had like 1,000 people on.
Was this? Was this? Was this when it was still Torriano? Or
yes. Yes.
What year was your first one? Just out of interest, if you remember.
What year did I start, or what year did I do TNT?
TNT for
It would have been, I was at Glasgow Uni, so it would have been 2012 or 13, maybe?
Okay, yeah, so we would have been doing that around the same time. I don't think, I don't recall ever seeing you there, but yeah, I started.
Yeah, I literally did one. I did one there, and I did one at Downstairs at the King's Head, and I did one.
Yeah.
I did the round. Oh, what was it called? I don't know if it's the Soho Comedy Club, not Soho Theatre.
Oh, yeah,
but But luckily one of my friend Sarah Cassidy, who lived in London briefly, but she's back in New York now, she was in Glasgow with me, and we sort of hung out a lot, and she was the one who said, let's go to London and do some gigs. She introduced me to Josie Long.
Oh, lovely.
And so one of my first gigs in London was her Treasures of the Black Heart gig.
Oh, fantastic.
Which was absolutely amazing. It was so nice, and I was just really, because, you know, obviously Josie is so, she's just, you know, no one needs to be as nice as she is, and she always is lovely. And
She seems like it, yeah.
Yeah, very supportive and very, you know, just like, absolutely, please come and do my gig, you know, just not even like, oh yeah, I guess you can do it, but, you know, making everyone feel welcome, and she's just great. So that was really nice. That made me think, like, oh, this is a nice place to hang out.
Yeah. So when did you actually move to London as a permanent thing?
2014.
Okay,
after I finished uni, and I went down and said, my parents sort of said, you know, we'll help you out if you want to do something while you're down there, like maybe do a master's or something, because that means, you know, you won't just be in London trying to be a comedian, which is a super depressing.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, just a bit of structure. So, you know, I was lucky enough to have that kind of support, and I did a film script writing master's at my film school. So I was quite lucky that I had, you know, a sort of something else to distract me, and also quite a few people who'd either moved from Scotland already down to London.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people I'd met at the Fringe who I sort of knew, so that felt good, because London for a long time was a very scary idea to me. You know, I couldn't picture living there or going there, because I'm from such a small capital, you know, it's just very genteel, and and London was, I'd never even been till I was 16, so that was the stage where I was like, okay, I'm gonna give this a go. So yeah, I did that degree for a year, and then I ended up just sort of staying there and keeping doing with comedy, and I got to know the weirdos really well. and ACMS, those were the two kind of you know, like groups of people I would say I hung out with the most.
Yeah, ACMS, sorry. I'm not familiar what that stands with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Alternative Comedy Memorial Society.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's John Luke Robertson, Tom Tuck.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's another one of those really great gigs where you can do absolutely anything, and the whole point is that it might be terrible.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy doing it because you just get real creative freedom and just get, you know, and the audiences are absolutely lovely.
Always up for it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Nice.
So how was your how was your experience of comedy change sort of like with the relocation to London or just with like the longer you've been doing it?
I'm sure this is like just everyone in comedy, but I think you just, the more you go, the less shit you put up with, like,
yeah,
the less terrible gigs you'll do for terrible money, or, you know, the less you'll, you know, I'm going to sit in the car for 5 hours to do this thing. Or,
yeah, yeah.
I think I've gotten a bit better at, like, making sure that I know exactly, you know, what is a good idea at the time and things. So, not that I've ever been at all spontaneous or interesting, but
no.
I think I've become much better at being like, this is the sort of thing I'm doing, I'm going to do them, I'm going to focus on that.
Yeah.
London was great because it, you know, I would love to be able to live in Scotland and do comedy, and lots of people I know do,
yeah,
but there's not the same amount of options in terms of styles,
no,
different nights. It's, you know, it's gone, there's a lot more emphasis on quite standard club stuff, and there are definitely people who do make other things happen, but, you know, it's like London's just got everything all the time, and as much as I'm sort of a bit of a snob about London in terms of I think we should be able to not live in London,
yeah,
not have to live in London.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am also, you know, I do enjoy the kind of stuff that you can do there. So.
Yeah. What are your favourite kind of nights to play, just off the back of that?
I'm sure every comedian just likes something where the audience are just very laid back and on board, and
yeah,
you just feel like you can play a bit.
Yeah,
you know?
Definitely.
Yeah. And any night, you know, where it's just like all your friends are on, and you're like, this is just lovely, because we're just hanging out. But yeah, definitely stuff where you feel like you can just be a bit more playful and a bit more creative, and it's not just you rattling off your set.
Yeah.
That's always, yeah, I think that's the best thing. But I'm sure, I don't think that's a particularly rare.
No, of course. So are there any bits where you kind of came up with in one of those more kind of like alternative experimental nights that are now kind of like a staple of your club set?
I can't remember which gig it was, but I did something at the Camden Head,
yeah,
in Camden, where I did a thing called Female Remake,
yes,
where I started asking, asking the audience.
I love that bit, yeah.
If they would, like, what would happen, what films they want to see remade, and that was fun, and then the good thing about that was that I could just go away and think about more films, and that's something I still do quite a lot, because it's one of those things, you know, audiences love interaction, and then there's some, you know, there's lots of parts of it I think work really well. The only downside is I can't ever watch all films ever.
No,
there's always going to be films people call out that I've not seen. It's not foolproof, but it's a bit that I do pretty regularly, because it's, you know, pretty much everyone loves films, and everyone's seen
At least kind of like the kind of big classics, kind of like,
it's just the stuff I'd say that's like a sort of, I don't know what you call it, the cultural
norm,
that for everyone knows the plots of these films, even if they've not seen them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, that's one of the things I think that has worked very well.
Yeah. So, I was going to ask you a bit about that bit in particular, actually, but just out of interest, before that, had you done anything similar to that before, or attempted any kind of like audience call out suggestions, and you ad lib a bit off that kind of? Was that a thing you did before?
I don't think so. I sort of, at the same sort of time, I started doing the history rap thing, where I do a rap suggested by the audience. But I don't know if I did that beforehand. And now I think I was pretty timid about that kind of thing before, because I was like, I think going into it, like, as quite an anxious young woman, there is that thing where, like, you're very aware of when you give the audience the mic, as it were.
Yeah.
There's certain types of people who you like to kind of purposefully make it uncomfortable or awkward, and that's, you know, I'm not always good at dealing with that. So no, I don't think so, no. I think it was all pretty structured before then, as far as I can remember. Again, it all just feels like a lifetime ago, so...
Yeah. absolutely. I'm really fascinated by that, because it's a thing that I've tried to do before, but I don't think I ever had that. I mean, I might do now, but I never had that confidence to just kind of sort of like allow myself to actually ad lib. So like I'd kind of like I attempted this one bit that I've only ever tried maybe twice, where I essentially attempted to answer why did the chicken cross the road as every religion, which is funnier in theory than it ended up being. But like I kind of meticulously researched different religions and kind of like pre-prepared answers for each one, I didn't really allow myself that option to just kind of go off it. And then I feel like, and then so every time anyone did actually call anything out, I had to like pause and think about it, and it was very obviously like it didn't work. And then obviously like there were always going to be ones which I didn't think of. So I'm just wondering, with that bit, did you kind of have any ideas for it beforehand, or did you just kind of sort of go with, okay, this could be a fun game to play, and then not really prepare for it beyond the initial premise?
I think the thing about things like films, for example, is that the genre, there's so many formulaic plots and predictable characters that I can't remember if I'd written any answers. I think maybe I'd written a couple of examples, but, you know, the thing is, a lot of the things that people shout out, you could give a similar answer,
right,
and it would apply, if that makes sense. So that was the good thing about, you know, like any film set before 1950, if it's about a professional, then the joke is that the woman will be a secretary or something.
Yeah.
She won't be allowed to do that profession.
Yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
So I think the reason it works is because there's just a lot of stuff to mine in that.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's a lot of films that you can really, I mean, often it, like, not often, but there's plenty of stuff that doesn't work, or sometimes I'll get too confident about a film and I actually think, and then I realise I don't really remember enough of the plot.
Yeah.
So I'm still not very good at kind of, I'm still working on being better at, like, deflecting if I can't come up with anything, which is, you know, one of the fears that I think held me back from doing more improv in the first place. But,
yeah, I definitely feel that.
I feel like a reviewer picked up on it, but I feel like audiences, they sort of, unless you kind of have a string of duds in a row, they don't really notice if you can't think of one or two, you know?
No, absolutely not. Like, oh, yeah, because I watched over your set with us to kind of come up with questions for this. And, yeah, so I think the first one you didn't know, but like it didn't interrupt the flow at all, and like you managed to sort of turn it into a, not necessarily a gag, but into a kind of thing to sort of keep the energy up and the thing and the thing going, and just kind of like apologising for having not seen all films. And
yeah, I mean that's sort of like, I'm kind of shooting in the foot there, in that, you know, it's an almost infinite possibilities.
Yeah.
But also, the other thing is sometimes people like to either yell out incredibly obscure films just to look smart and also annoy you, or they like to yell out Prawns, which is very boring and is only ever suggested by middle-aged men.
Of course it is.
and it's just, oh, people love shouting out Holocaust films because I think it'll be funny. Oh,
of course they do.
Yeah, and it's just like, I think that's the thing about heckling generally, is that hecklers never get that whatever they heckle has already been said 1,000 times. And that is why the comic will almost always come back with something better, just because the heckle is not original.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, because for ages I was absolutely terrified of it. And I haven't had to deal with heckles very often, but like I was always in awe of just how people always manage to handle it. Like, especially like when you watch people like, I don't know, sort of like Jimmy Carr, who kind of would like call for it because he just enjoys doing that. Like, I'd always be really impressed with it, and then I realised that most of them are either fairly stock responses that you can use in most situations, or just kind of there's only about 5 different types of heckle.
Exactly. It's I mean, it's one of the things about stand up is once you start to break it down, certain illusions, I guess, that make it seem, I mean, it is impressive, but it's also like, you know, it's like that the first time you realise that comedians do the same material more than once and you sort of think we're cheated.
Yeah, it's a huge revelation. Or like when you realise stuff like Mock the Week is mostly scripted than that.
Yeah, and there's lots, but the whole reason all this works is that there's, you know, most people out there don't think about the fact that people do the same material twice. You know, they are kind of caught up in that idea that the comedian is just riffing, and that's kind of the magic of it. But we're all liars.
Yeah, we are all liars. In fact, like, yeah, I did have a mate who I used to gig with years ago, who I don't think does stand up anymore, but like he used to insist on writing a new set every time he did a gig, for that very reason. And I kept trying to talk him out of it, going like no, you've got a good set on here, but also like it wasn't perfect when you did it. You can actually develop it. You don't need to just chuck it now. And then just refused to.
I think you want to get that sweet spot between never ever changing your material and doing the same thing for 10 years, and keeping changing it so often that you never get a chance to hone it or improve it. And it's so tempting when something doesn't work, or when, like, you know, I've had friends who've kind of rewritten Fringe shows in the middle of the Fringe because they feel like it's not working.
Yeah,
but the problem there is that you're not, you know, you keep rewriting it every day, they're not really ever going to learn it or kind of get it to a point where you're happy.
Have you ever had that with any of your shows?
Definitely. I think, I mean, not like the whole show, but there's definitely been bits this will eventually become a joke. And that's sort of the frustrating thing, is that I think
the
Fringe used to be a lot more pro that, and now it's very much like your show better be incredibly polished on day one. So it's a shame, but I think a lot of people come out of the Fringe feeling like their show is better than when they went in. And
it makes sense if you're doing if you're doing like 30 odd days in a row. Like, it'd be upsetting if it wasn't.
That would be worrying.
Are you the comedian you thought you'd be when you started?
I'm trying to remember what I thought I was going to be. I think roughly.
Yeah.
I didn't plan to be musical originally, so that was kind of in my head.
Yeah.
I probably planned on being a lot cleverer and more American. Does that make sense? Like.
Yeah, I think so.
Instead of a bit more offbeat, maybe. But although, I mean, there's also always that thing of whoever you've been watching is who you imitate first. So when I first got on the scene in Scotland, it was all the boys were either trying to be Frankie Boyle or trying to be Kevin Bridges.
Yeah.
There's no in between. And it's really hard to get with bad Kevin Bridges, Frankie Boyle.
Yeah.
I can
imagine as well, like, because people trying to be Frankie Boyle is just saying offensive things without any thought to the joke structure or the.
That's exactly what it was.
That's definitely a common thing in men, and I definitely went through. I was never quite that bad, but like I did do one specific set where like the entire premise was just. It was when I was comparing ones, and it was just like a way to kind of work. It was basically a rip off of like the Jimmy Carr whole thing of like the kind of scale of offensive jokes to work out where the what the audience's limit was. It was like a less good version of that. And if I could undo any bit of my stand up, like sort of back catalogue, it would probably be that bit.
there was a lot of just very depressing. I'm sure this is because a lot of them were just like teenage boys as well, so you know, this is what they were into. But jokes about wanking and paedophiles and just
obviously,
all that stuff. Yeah, and then when I went to uni and sort of down to London as well, I noticed everyone was trying to be, most people were trying to be Stuart Lee. So
that's always really cringy. Yeah.
Yes, it was definitely a lot of student. I think a lot of student comedians. Want to be Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of, again, it's just interesting to see what people do. But I also think, you know, it's pretty normal when you're trying to get into your rhythm of kind of imitating others until you get your. And I find I still, like, if I watch a comedian for an hour or something and I come out, I will start writing in their voice, which is.
Yeah, I do that a lot.
Yeah, and then you're like, oh, this is great. And you're like, I can't use any of this. I wouldn't say any of this. So,
yeah.
it's interesting how we kind of cling on to those other people's things.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's a thing that bugged me for ages when I was starting out, because like, I don't like... the first time I saw Andrew O'Neill, I'd already been kind of going in that direction anyway, just of my own kind of development. And
I can see that.
And then someone's like, oh, check this person out, and then I was just like, immediately from that point, just everything was more that, and I was like, no, I need to be less, and like it was I wouldn't have minded too much, but it was a thing that was brought up a lot, mostly at kind of competitions and stuff. So it was just,
I think also though, if you have long dark hair,
that's it. Yeah.
people always decide, like, that, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you look like someone,
even if you're kind of, yeah, even if you're slightly similar, you'll get
the same race as them or something,
yeah.
It's like...
Oh, yeah.
But I remember quite early I was told I was a bit like Maria Bamford, and first I was like, oh, I don't think so. I think I'm the only person who's hilarious. It was just Maria Bamford. And then I went and looked her up, and she was like, okay, my favourite comedian of all time, I think. I don't think I've ever... We don't really similar. Like, she does obviously lots of impressions and things.
Yeah.
But I definitely think we have a similar kind of outlook on the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But... Yeah, I hope I've never imitated her as such. I just love her, so.
No, but the weird thing is, I feel like I probably imitated people like Tony Law more.
Mm.
But I think, as you were saying, because I didn't really look like him as much, and, like, yeah. I never really got that comparison. And, like, because I think, there was a time when, sort of, like, shouty male comedians was definitely a thing I liked a lot. Like the more kind of surreal ones was definitely a big thing I got into.
Yeah.
A few years ago. And weirdly, since then I've not had a comparison to any of them. I don't know how that happened, because like I'd definitely pull me up on it, but I think
the person I probably imitate the most is Bill Bailey, and again, no one has really thought of that, because I am, in most respects, nothing like him. So
I suppose like Bill Bailey if you're not doing musical stuff as well, I think you're not going to get that.
Yes, exactly. And when you are getting musical stuff, it's very frustrating, because I think there's a real stigma around musical comedy.
There is, Although Bill Bailey's really interesting with, like, I wouldn't is. He's a really interesting musical comedian, because he does comedy about music a lot more than comedy songs, which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
Yes, I think that's probably why I like him as well. I like it's less, because the thing about musicals, like comedy songs, is that they're quite easy to do, not badly, but like it's easy to get away with a lot, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's true in also in stand up as well, but it's just different, It's just, and so I think there's that idea that you're not trying as hard when you're doing music or whatever, or you don't deserve it as much, which is sometimes true. I think if I'd had access to things like, if I'd been able to bring the piano with me everywhere, I might have stuck with it a bit longer.
Yeah.
I really hated that kind of girl with the ukulele sort of this idea of this being a stereotype, and I just hated people weren't really listening to the comedy if they were immediately thinking she's like this but and without any music, people just compare you to the female comedians anyway, because they also have vaginas, so you can't really win.
No you can't. Which is bizarre, is like that most white male comedians are interchangeable in my eyes, but that's just...
Yeah, exactly. It's like no one ever compares them, because there's something, they're allowed to be more unique somehow, even though they are more similar.
it's fucking bizarre. I mean, well, it's not bizarre, it's misogyny and racism, but it's just...
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I don't quite know how to phrase this question, but so... When you started, because like you do like tackle a few kind of like social, political, and feministy kind of subjects. Do you think that when you started stand up was that present, and do you think that what came first? Like, did you have something you wanted to say and needed a platform to do it, or did you kind of sort of get that platform and then use it to start saying those things? If that makes any sense.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. I was political before I started doing comedy, but I never mixed them up at first. I was more concerned about joke writing.
Yeah, sure.
Like I did a lot more kind of, like, not one line so much, but, like, bits than I would do, like, long kind of discussion type stuff.
Yeah.
And then I think the more you do it, obviously, the more you kind of find your voice and feel like you can say stuff or find interesting ways to say stuff. But also I think there was still, I'm sure it's still there now, but there was that stigma at the time where, as a woman, you couldn't mention it too much about being a woman, otherwise people would go, oh, it's one of those women comedians talking about being a woman, we're not interested in this.
Yeah.
And I think that's, yeah, you either embraced it fully and were like, I'm one of those feminist comedians who talks about women stuff and, you know, a certain demographic will be into this and no one else will.
Yeah.
Or you kind of go, I'm not going to address it at all and I'm just going to do jokes and then, you know, maybe feel a bit guilty for kind of never discussing stuff that actually happens to men people.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do find it really interesting. And yeah, it's definitely a stigma with female comedians. And I've seen a few people, like a few women who've kind of sort of internalised that and sort of made, like, the first couple of years doing comedy really, like, make themselves the anti that and sort of really sort of make reference to that.
Absolutely.
And then just, like, sort of, like, destroy feminism kind of thing. And then luckily, like, most of them kind of got past that.
I think it's a natural reaction.
Yeah,
in a way, like, you want to be embraced by this community who
are
not into that or whatever, and you also, you know, in that kind of token otherness thing, you kind of get aware that you've been given this lucky place that, and so you kind of end up pissing yourself against other women.
Yeah. The men have let you speak, kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, there's only room for a certain amount of us, so, you know, we better be better than the other ones. And I'm definitely still guilty of that. I think I get quite, like, wound up with the idea that there's not enough space for all of us, which isn't true.
No.
And it's not our fault either. I think a lot of female comics really struggle with, or certainly have in the past, like, that idea of togetherness, because we're just made to feel like everything's competition, and that's kind of true of everything in life with women.
Yeah.
And other, you know,
yeah,
people
definitely.
Who are marginalised. So yeah, but I'm trying to improve. You know, just trying to do more. You know, it's just nice when you learn that there's room for all of us and that you don't have to. It's, you know, other women aren't the problem. It's what we've been told.
Yeah.
About how we need to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, there was definitely that thing where, like, if a woman went on stage and talked about periods, part of you to go, don't do that, because now they'll just think that's how we all are, because there's that thing of that one person has to represent all of you.
Yeah.
But I think it's changed a lot, which is really nice, and
yeah.
I think it just depends also the kind of gigs I'm doing.
Yeah, it makes sense, because I was going to say, like, it does seem like we're kind of moving away from that, but then I remembered that I'm mostly sort of gigging my own, for want of a better word, echo chamber kind of thing. So, like, I've never really encountered that attitude from the gigs I do.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
It's nice to know.
Yeah, it is nice to know. But it's not necessarily representative as the whole circuit.
I think we are getting better.
Yeah.
I think, but yeah, also I think it is nice. Once you've done those really nice supportive gigs where you can say anything, you don't really want to go back from that.
Yeah, definitely. And it's nice as well that, like, more, like, there are slowly more female comedians kind of getting into the limelight, because it's like, I mean, it was evident from you saying, like, all of your first kind of favourite comedians that you listed were all men, and, like, I think that's a thing from sort of, like, growing up in the 90s and 2000s, is that, like, because I think maybe Victoria Wood, probably the only...
Yeah.
Certainly the biggest stand-up name in of those kind of generations. And then after her, like, probably Sarah Millican in terms of stand-up. Like, and
that's Joe Brandon is the other
Joe
one.
Brandon, Joe Brandon as well, yeah.
I think the thing is...
But there's still a big sort of generational jump between those two, like, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And the fact is there wasn't a huge... Because there weren't many women, there wasn't a huge range of different, types of women. So I, for example, people like, you know, Joan Rivers and that kind of mold of very bitchy, glamorous female American comedians was just not something I could relate to or had any, felt like he was talking about anything I knew. You know, I was much more, could relate much more to someone like Ed Byrne or to Bill Bailey. But then obviously, you know, you do find out about more people, and then someone like Maria Bamford. It's just great, because I was like, oh good, women can be weird and awkward, and they don't just have to be like sassy and glamorous and always have a bitchy come down for a bit, put down for everything, you know, because that's not the kind of comment I can relate to personally. So
yeah, definitely.
So yeah, it's nice to have more options, really, and more people you can, because we're not all
no, absolutely
gonna be like Joan Rivers. So
is that where you're because I've seen one of your shows on Next Up, the great title, Glamorous Photo, is it? Is that where that is that the premise?
Other way around, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. I remembered all the words.
Yeah, no, you did. It's just, you're halfway.
Halfway, right? 50 points. Yeah, so was that where the kind of premise for that came from?
Yeah, but basically that, I think I was just feeling very intimidated by what was expected of female comedians, especially in terms of success. And I feel like there's still a huge emphasis on female comedians who are on, you know, on TV and things like that to be very attractive and very polished in a way that we don't expect male comedians to be in.
Oh, definitely.
Jessie Long kind of touched on it a bit in her last show, and I would have loved to have seen her go deeper, but there is this thing of, the kind of expectations that I still feel are there on women when they're doing comedy is to kind of, you can't really play the idiot because we women can't be, you know, we're trying to prove we are clever, so we can't look stupid even if that's funnier.
Yeah.
It was definitely that kind of feeling, like just wishing that, in a way wishing I was one of those comedians. It looks really fun.
I was going to say, did you have fun writing all of the bits in that kind of persona?
Oh, the dick jokes and stuff.
Yeah.
It was funny because people, I don't know if it's just the sort of people come to see me, but people were, you know, even though I felt like it's pretty obviously not real, some people were still a bit like, oh, that's quite rude.
Yeah. Yeah, I did notice that in the video. The audience didn't quite know how to react to those bits.
It is, I mean, it's sort of, I've kind of dug my own grave there because it is kind of like, what I give them is kind of confusing in terms of like, what should they actually, you know, is this a character or not? But I also think it's funny the way people, you know, you think everyone's really into dark humour and then you tell a dick joke and someone goes, oh my goodness. you know, and it's a bit like, oh, come on, everyone. It's fine, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm a prude, so, you know. it was a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah.
Although I think the one I bought for the red one, every deck of the zip got slightly more stuck.
Oh no.
And by the end they had to safety pin me into it. So.
Oh no.
The glamour of showbiz.
Fantastic.
It was not an expensive dress, so.
Oh, that's good then.
Which is maybe where I'm going wrong. Maybe I should start investing more, but I just can't bother this. Well, I mean, who knows what's going to happen, so.
Oh yeah, exactly. Wonderful.
Cool.
Yeah, sorry, I've gone on for about an hour now, so I'll start wrapping this up. Just final kind of question. It's kind of two variations of it, whichever one's easier for you to answer. So, either what's the best advice you've ever received in comedy, or if you can't think of any, what advice would you give to a younger you doing comedy?
Ooh, okay.
Feel free to take a bit of time to think about that.
I might have to take a bit of time. I feel like it's silly, because I feel like it's quite a common question, and I could never think of anything in the moment.
No. I can think about it until someone asks me, and then I forget all of it. Like,
Josie Long once said, if she's having a really bad gig, she likes to imagine she's gigging on the moon, which I think means, you know, just like gigging to no one and nothing, and it doesn't matter, and you just give it your all, and you kind of zone out of the audience. I don't know if I've ever actually managed to do that when I'm doing a bad gig. And then... I think the thing I always forget, but I always come back to, and I do think important, is just write what you think is funny.
Yeah, that'll definitely.
Because I think a lot of us second guess ourselves, and we go, should I be doing this thing that this person's doing? Because that seems very popular.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, I think if you don't think it's funny, there's no point in doing it.
Oh, absolutely,
And, you know, the chances are, if you think it's funny, other people will, or, you know, at least some other people. So... you know, sometimes I get into that place where I kind of start writing in a certain way, trying to force something, and then I think, no, you know, just write what you actually think. So it's pretty simple advice, but I think it's good to remember when you're kind of beating yourself up for not being a certain style or a certain, you know, thing.
I definitely think so, and I had a really interesting kind of thing that illustrates that. When I was doing because I studied comedy and writing performance at university, because that's what I wanted to do with my money, and when I was doing my sort of final projects, like not quite dissertation, but that kind of thing. So I was doing it on kind of alternative and political comedy, and like for some reason I was trying to challenge myself to do a very centrist political thing, like sort of take the piss out of both sides kind of thing, and like I was constantly trying to write kind of like making fun of the left kind of stuff, and I couldn't do it, and then like I had one bit that was kind of a rant and then it wasn't funny and I also didn't agree with it and I was getting really frustrated with myself because a lot of the comedy I liked kind of fell into that category, or at least I kind of saw it that way, so I was really trying to do it, and then I think from that point on, like I became more left wing after trying to do that for so long, just because I couldn't find any ways to make it funny that weren't like obviously missing the point.
I think if your heart's not in something, you kind of instinctively know that you're never going to quite get to that thing if it's not actually something you truly believe in.
Absolutely.
And in that case, you might as well just write what you want. Or if you're being paid to write it for someone else, keep doing it. Because sometimes you just have to write on things. If it's your stuff, you've just gotta feel real or truthful.
Definitely.
In some way.
Yeah.
Otherwise, other people don't connect to it.
And that was Eleanor Morton. Thanks again very much for Eleanor to having a chat with us. Again, really enjoyed this conversation. If you have enjoyed these podcasts, please do let us know on social media. We have reached the point where if we want to put more episodes of this up on Podbean, we are going to have to pay for a premium subscription, which we are more than happy to do. But we're not going to do it if this isn't something that you are enjoying listening to. So if you are enjoying them, please do let us know. And then we'll know that it's worth investing in this platform to make more of these episodes. If not, we'll find an alternative. We maybe just put them up on YouTube or something with some pictures, which will be more of a headache to upload and it will take longer, but it will also be free. So that is the advantage of that. But so if you like having them here, let us know. Or if there's any other podcast platforms you particularly like, we can look into them, see what kind of deals we can get there. Thank you all, everyone who has been supporting us. You can, if you'd like to support us financially, you can do that via PayPal or Patreon. PayPal, if you just go to our website, www.blizzardcomedy.co.uk/ I think it's support us. Either way, go on our website and you can follow the buttons to the support page, which will have the PayPal link. And Patreon is at Blizzard Comedy, same as Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you can't afford to support us financially, that's fine. Chat about us on social media, tell all of your friends how great we are and how they absolutely need to empty their wallets for us right now, because God, we need it. Thanks for listening and supporting us, and I hope you're all doing well and staying safe during these uncertain times. I feel like there's more I need to add. Fuck the Tories, Black Lives Matter, trans rights, really important sentiments currently, due to everything that's going on. I mean, they're important all the time, but especially now. So thanks for listening, and we will hopefully see you next time.